From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now. And history was made on the Korean Peninsula today. The leaders of North and South Korea met face-to-face and pledged to eliminate nuclear weapons. The North's Kim Jong-un and the South's Moon Jae-in also agreed to work toward a peace treaty to formally end the Korean War. Today's historic handshake and meeting, complete with an honor guard in 19th-century uniforms, marked only the third time the leaders of the two countries had met since 1953, when combat ended. Here's Kim speaking through an interpreter.
We are living next door to each other. There's no reason why we should fight each other. We are just one nation.
At the White House today, President Trump said a lot of positive things have happened over the last 24 hours, and his meeting with Kim will be set up shortly. Sung Yoon Lee is professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. And Professor Lee, first I'd like to hear your reaction to what you saw and heard today. I mean, the first time a North Korean leader had ever set foot inside South Korea.
Well, the optics were gripping. A lot of smiles, hugs, even holding hands between the two leaders. A lot of reassuring messages, no more war, permanent peace, denuclearization, peace park instead of the demilitarized zone, which is the most fortified, militarized border in the world. Now, if I had not seen this movie play out before, I would be less skeptical, but I see this as a typical North Korean ploy. Why? Because it makes sense to do that. North Korea is not crazy. They don't just relentlessly provoke. It pays for Pyongyang to placate after provoking. So 2018 was an opportune time for the Kim regime after that banner ballistic year last year. It was time to come down a rung or two on the ladder of escalation, engage South Korea, send his sister to South Korea for the Winter Olympics, soften up the United States, pay a visit to China, and get the Russian president and the Japanese prime minister to line up.
Professor Lee, let's dig a little deeper into your skepticism there. This meeting comes in the wake of missile tests and bellicose rhetoric of the past year. Why are you so skeptical Kim, you know, is not really going to negotiate his nuclear weapons away?
For the very same reasons you just mentioned, because this charm offensive comes right after a protracted period of provocations. In the late 90s, the father, Kim Jong-il, fired a missile over Japan in 1998, really freaking out the Japanese, and then started a deadly naval skirmish with South Korea in 99, and then all of a sudden changed his tune from molto agitato to placido in 2000, called for a summit meeting with the South Korean president, paid his first visit to China a fortnight before the meeting, some 6 years after coming into power, just as Kim Jong-un did in late March, and then pocketed $500 million from the South, then turned to Bill Clinton, sent an envoy to the Clinton White House, who carried the message of invitation for President Clinton to visit North Korea. The next year in 01, met with Putin. In 02, Kim Jong-il hosted the Japanese leader for the first time in North Korea. And by doing all these things, the weird dictator is accepted as the legitimate leader of a not-so-abnormal nation. And Kim Jong-un is trying to do that, an image makeover, but more importantly, to buy time and money with which he can perfect his own nuclear posture review.
So you see it as a makeover attempt, but there were important pledges today. Do you think President Trump is ready for this major diplomatic effort, you know, with the leader of North Korea to turn this into some kind of reality? He, Trump, is relatively untested in these waters and can be unpredictable.
Well, institutional memory in any government is rather short. It's rather thin. Moreover, it's all been said before in the first inter-Korean summit in 2000 and then repeated in 2007, the second Korean summit. Now, I think President Trump, moved by hubris or conviction that he is capable of taming the North Korean dictator, is rather unprepared for the meeting itself. In the past, American officials, academics, journalists who have met with Kim the First, the Second, and even as Pompeo did just a few weeks ago with Kim Jong-un himself, have always come away impressed because such is the low bar they carry into the encounter. When Kim comes across as not crazy, but actually rather well-informed, self-effacing, he has a sense of humor, says strangely pleasing things like, oh, we understand that the U.S. troops in the region, in South Korea and Japan, they play a constructive stabilizing role, so I will not call for their immediate withdrawal. Then the outsider comes away from this encounter utterly convinced that he has gained some deep insight to the North Korean regime, mostly by virtue of his own ingenuity and empathy. It's an elaborate trap that Kim has been preparing for many years, and I think President Trump faces the risk of walking right into that trap.
Professor Lee, given the real threat of conflict, if this latest diplomatic effort fizzles out, what do you think it would take to make real progress?
At all cost, do not prematurely relax sanctions. For any U.S. government, the temptation to settle for an expedient deal and lift sanctions to get North Korea out of the headlines for a few months, that remains a so-called rational option.
Sung Yoon Lee is a professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Professor Lee, thanks so much.
Thank you.
25 years ago this week, the Holocaust Memorial Museum opened on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and from the start relied on survivors to help educate visitors. But as the number of living survivors dwindles, the museum has to prepare for a future without them. Michaela Lefrak from member station WAMU has our story.
At least once a week, Helena Lipman-Yashiroff Peabody brushes her gray blonde hair and carefully applies makeup at her home in Bethesda, Maryland. Then the 85-year-old goes to the U.S. Holocaust Museum, where she's been volunteering for more than 15 years. When she arrives, the petite woman with clear blue eyes passes through security and into the bustling, light-filled lobby.
Every Thursday, I'm at the desk over there, and they usually manage to get a group of kids to, you know, so I tell my story to them as well.
Peabody lived through the Holocaust, and like many survivors, she remembers the war in remarkable detail. The roundup of Jews in her Polish town, the hiding, the ghetto, the mass graves, the escape by train, and the bomb that took two of her fingers.
I mean, you don't forget those things, and I'm one of the last eyewitnesses.
Peabody is part of a team of more than 80 survivors who volunteer at the museum. Often, the survivors who work at the information desk are the first people visitors speak to.
Three of us plus you in school. Hi there, welcome.
Almost always the thing that people talk about that impacted them the most was an encounter with a survivor.
Diane Saltzman directs Survivor Affairs for the museum. She says survivors have been working with the museum since it was founded.
They translate documents. They sit at a public space in the museum and engage with our visitors on a day-to-day basis. And some of them have taken our rather intensive tour guide training.
It's a well-oiled, mutually beneficial system. Since it opened in 1993, the museum's hosted more than 43 million visitors and worked with hundreds of survivors. But time is taking its toll. Saltzman says she's been to 80th, 90th, even 100th birthday parties for aging survivors.
So our oldest survivor who is still volunteering is 101. It's a challenge from a personal perspective for all of us because these are not just people that come to work every day. These are our family.
Nearby, in a big office with views of the National Mall, sits Sarah Bloomfield, the museum's director. She's been trying to prepare for a world without survivors since before the museum even opened.
That was really the question. Would our work be worthy? And would our work speak to the future as much as to the past? It was a big challenge.
And it still is. Despite the museum's many successes, the Holocaust is fading from memory. A recent survey found that two-thirds of millennials do not know Auschwitz was a concentration camp. And 80% of Americans have not visited a Holocaust museum.
So keeping the lessons of the Holocaust relevant and reaching a global audience are two of our biggest challenges going forward.
Bloomfield says the museum plans to expand its collections, translate its website into more languages, and launch more programs to study and prevent genocides globally. To do all that, it recently revised its 10-year fundraising goal to $1 billion by 2023. The museum is already two-thirds of the way there.
And we wanted to make that announcement while the survivors were still with us. We thought it was a very important message to them that long after they're gone, this institution will be financially secure enough.
For her part, Helena Peabody, the volunteer, says she's noticed an uptick in interest in her story.
Now it's very, very, very popular for some reason, because I think we're dying out so fast. So everybody wants to talk about it and to bear, you know, have somebody bear witness.
She's echoing another survivor, Elie Wiesel, who said those same words in his speech at the museum's dedication ceremony.
For the dead and the living, we must bear witness.
Wiesel died in 2016, but his words are engraved on one of the museum's granite walls, forever visible to all who choose to visit. For Here and Now, I'm Michaela Lefrak in Washington.
It's an historic day, the leaders of North and South Korea meeting, pledging to work for complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. This week, after more than 40 years, police in California think they've found the Golden State Killer. And what's up with Kanye West? Let's bring in Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, to look at how the news is filtering through social media, where a lot of people get their news. So let's see what they're seeing. Hi, Femi.
Hi there, Robin.
First, this North and South Korea announcement. Leaders said they would work with the U.S. and China to declare an official end to the Korean War, seek a permanent peace agreement, historic, maybe promoted by President Trump's rhetoric, maybe because the longtime sanctions are working. But what's been the reaction on social media?
Enthusiastic so far. This is a developing story. So as people are thinking and seeing the pictures, this is such a picture-rich story, ripe for posting. People are trying to unpack what's happening. Is this really happening? One tweet that I picked up just a few hours ago was from the AFP correspondent, Ha Won-young, and we could actually see Kim Jong-un's handwriting. It was in the Peace House Summit guest book, and she translated what Kim Jong-un had actually written. A new history begins now, at the starting point of history and the era of peace. Hashtag Inter-Korea Summit.
Kim Jong-un uses a hashtag.
Not him.
Oh, she
Thank
did.
Thank you, Robin. Okay. That's what she said, not what he said. Okay. But I'm sure he would. The reaction underneath that tweet, thousands and thousands of retweets, thousands of shares.
Really?
Twitter handle Trump says, wow, peace through strength. MAGA. And Zisu says, this brings tears to my eyes. Hannah Chung, this is huge. My family just applauded. A lot of enthusiasm, a lot of people being carried along by the potential historical moment that this could be.
Well, you know, many Americans are questioning if it's real, if it'll last, what it will mean politically. But we forget, families were riven apart by this in our lifetime, some of us, and so some people. And so, you know, this is hugely emotional. So we'll continue to follow that. And the benefit of social media, we got an interpretation there. But also this week, California police arrested that suspect they think is the Golden State Killer, responsible for murders and rapes in the 70s and 80s up and down California. We were thinking of Patton Oswalt, his wife, Michelle McNamara's terrific book in which she reminded us it was so scary in California.
Indeed.
People were doing things like hanging tambourines, you know, from the ceiling, taking shifts so nobody went to sleep. They were so afraid of this attacker. But the police apparently found this person, a former policeman, their suspect, because of DNA from a genealogy website, and that's caused some concerns.
Yeah, and those are the websites where they say, we can find out where are you originally from, what part are you? Are you part Nigerian? Are you part Native American Indian? Are you part Polish? And you send off your DNA and they come back and give you some analyses. These are commercial websites, commercial organizations. And what the police did was they looked through using the DNA that they had found at various crime scenes from the Golden State Killer. And they had a match with about 100 people. And they looked at that, they narrowed it down, and that is how they found their suspect. There's a lot of small print that goes on with these DNA websites, and if you don't read it very carefully, you could be in trouble, because it does say sometimes that they can use the information, they can use your data, and they may be able to give your data up to law enforcement. All of those ethical questions. Right. And normally with those data websites, the ethical questions are about knowing your history of your health. And what about if your employer knows that, or your health insurance company knows that you have a history of a particular kind of disease? Will your insurance go up? That was the ethical question that we were wrestling with when we were looking at DNA websites. Not could you be tracked down by the police?
Yeah.
This is a new one.
I just want to quickly mention a couple of things. It's been 4 years since the Flint water crisis began this week. And some people there are still without water. They're still using the hashtag Flint water crisis. And 10-year-old Mari Kopany, also known as Little Miss Flint, we spoke with her in the past. She spoke at a rally on Wednesday to mark this anniversary.
Water is life, but for Flint, bottled water is life. 4 years. If we were in a higher income area, this crisis would have never hit the four-year mark.
You know it.
And so we just want to know, check out the hashtag Flint water crisis, because it's still on and it's still being used. But we have to talk about Kanye West, the rapper.
We have to talk about Kanye West. People in Flint might disagree with you.
Yes.
The only thing I would say about that hashtag, Robin, is that it's still ongoing. When the hashtag has a part where it can go on and on and on and on, you know that there either is something behind that or there is a continuing problem. So the hashtag is being used, Flint water crisis, exactly the same way it was being used 4 years ago,
right,
with people showing
it's
the
amazing
dirty water,
you know,
that
what
they're being expected to drink.
And I've decided maybe
that's important.
Maybe
sorry, Kanye.
No, I was going to say, maybe we don't have to talk about Kanye West. So I'm going to skip him for a second. If we have time, we will, because remember Flint water crisis still going on. But also, Kate Middleton, I just want to get to this. The Duchess of Cambridge gave birth to her third child, Louis Arthur Charles, on Monday, and came out hours later in heels. Let's listen.
How are you feeling?
Oh, my God. How are you feeling? How are you looking? Amazing. And now people, women all over social media are showing how they looked after birth.
Yeah, Laura says, Kate Middleton gives birth and walks out looking flawless 7 hours later. Sophie Veshbau, per usual, Kate Middleton looks better immediately after giving birth than I do 99.9% of the time. Mums are actually posting pictures of how they looked and how Kate Middleton looks, the Duchess of Cambridge, looks after giving birth. One posted one of her looking like Rocky after doing several rounds in the ring. And Ellie Taylor breaks down her day. My day, 11 a.m, wake up, eat cheese, 4 p.m, put bra on, 6 p.m, take bra off, eat cheese. Kate Middleton's day, 11 a.m, birth human, 4 p.m, blow dry, full makeup, 6 p.m, present new heir to media, looking red carpet ready. I have to say, internet people, Kate Middleton, the Duchess of Cambridge, she has people to make her look
yes
that good.
And we should say, just to give Kanye West a little bit of do, he's been tweeting his support of President Trump this week, and good for him. Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, thanks as always.
You're so welcome.
The new French film, Godard Mon Amour, is about the trailblazing director Jean-Luc Godard, told through the eyes of his muse, his first wife. It's the familiar story of the difficult but brilliant artist and the woman he loved. But NPR contributor Andrew Lapin explains how the film knocks the domineering artist down a peg.
If you ask anyone who's studied film over the last 50 years to list the greatest directors of all time, there's one name that's probably going to come up more than any other.
Jean-Luc Godard.
Un film de Jean-Luc Godard.
Le nouveau film traditionnel de Jean-Luc Godard.
As one of the creators of the French New Wave, Jean-Luc Godard helped redefine what movies are. He broke all the traditional rules of filmmaking by introducing rapid-fire editing styles and by often literally throwing philosophy in your face with title cards and graffiti. One of the most famous scenes of his career is a 7-minute-long traffic jam in the movie Weekend, where, in one shot, we see all representatives of modern Western life stalled out on the side of the road, honking their horns incessantly. The new movie Godard Mon Amour depicts the moment in 1968 when Godard shifted from fun, frothy experimentation into a kind of full-on political filmmaking, desperately wanting to be the voice of France's new youth movement. The filmmakers show Godard as a talented man who brought us films like Breathless and Contempt, but treats his fans, colleagues, and romantic partners with, well, contempt. In one scene from Godard Mon Amour, the director, played by Louis Garrel, insists he doesn't want to be like everyone else with their boring bourgeois pastimes. The movie is told from the perspective of Godard's first wife and muse, Anne Wojcicki, played by Stacey Martin. She was 17 when she starred in Godard's movie La Chinoise in 1967, and in the midst of the radical student protests sweeping through France, the director fell in love with his student. At the same time, he was going around insisting that the old Godard was dead, leading a successful charge to shut down the Cannes Film Festival in solidarity with the student movement, and interrupting activist meetings to go on weird, sometimes anti-Semitic rants, behavior that drove Wojcicki crazy.
C'est pas compliqué, faut choisir. C'est soit la politique, soit le cinéma.
La révolution, elle doit d'abord commencer par soi-même.
After a while, Wojcicki was done being a party to Godard's narcissistic behavior, and done with being trapped as a muse with no agency over her career. She wanted out. And you might too, because this movie's version of Godard really is that obnoxious. Here he is berating a film student who decided to fanboy over him on the street.
Je vous avais envoyé une lettre au cahier.
Oui, mais c'est extrêmement ennuyeux pour moi, là.
Godard Mon Amour is directed by Michel Hachanavicius, who made The Artist, an homage to silent movies that won the Oscar in 2012. He's really good at mimicking the look of a Godard film, but it's a cutesy version of Godard, with all the quirky title screens and editing tricks from the earlier films Godard later tried to disown. Yet even as the movie's winking at us, it lets us see this guy through his wife's myth-dismantling eyes. It tries to have it both ways, honoring its subject while humiliating him. Godard probably won't pay it much attention, though. At age 87, the man is still making strange, challenging work. Next month, on the 50th anniversary of the time he shut down Cannes because times were too political to show movies, he'll be premiering his new movie, an exploration of the modern Arab world called The Image Book. And he'll be premiering it at Cannes. Le Vietnam brûle, moi je hurle, Mao, Mao. Johnson rigole, for Here and Now, I'm Andrew Lapin. Le napalm
coule, moi je roule, Mao, Mao. You're listening to Here and Now.
And there's more bad news today for Wells Fargo. According to the Wall Street Journal, the Labor Department is looking into whether the bank steered customers into higher-cost retirement accounts and pressured them to buy funds that generated more revenue for the company. And a week ago, the bank agreed to pay a $1 billion fine for charging people for car insurance they didn't need, among other things. The Federal Reserve also penalized the bank earlier this year over those millions of fake bank accounts. Emily Glazer co-reported today's story in the journal. Emily, this is when you put it all together like that, pretty damning. But start with the 401k plans, the retirement plans. The Labor Department looking into how Wells Fargo administers these 401k plans on behalf of other companies. So what are the concerns again?
Thanks, Robin. Indeed, there is a lot going on here. In terms of these 401k plans, Wells Fargo has relationships with a variety of companies where it administers their employees' retirement savings. In this case, the bank had a program where it would roll over employees' less expensive 401k plans to more expensive IRA plans. And in some cases, the bank would also put those clients in their own proprietary products or third-party products where they would just make more additional fees.
Well, I remember when we were talking about proposed regulations that people who handled money of other people had to actually have their better interest in mind. And everybody was astonished that that already didn't happen. But here you have the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. Doesn't it say you have to put the client's interest ahead of your own?
Indeed. And there was a lot going on, under the Obama administration with the Department of Labor's fiduciary rule that got put on hold. But you're right. When it comes to the ERISA, what it's known as Employee Retirement Income Security Act, that's administered by the Labor Department. And that law, goes across with the Internal Revenue Service, Pension Benefits Guarantee Corporation. It's very serious. And there's an issue with conflict of interest. And if you're doing the best thing for the client, and if it's If it's found that you're not, there are a bunch of different types of penalties for these so-called ERISA violations. It could be civil penalties like fines or some sort of plan, payment plan to a beneficiary, or even criminal penalties for these kinds of violations. So it's very serious.
Yeah. Look, this is added to the fake bank accounts, the auto insurance people didn't need. It's sounding like the housing crisis, selling mortgages that people knew were going to fail. Robocalling people, to get them to buy mortgages. I'm sorry if I'm being, stunned here, but how do you get to be a bank and do this?
You are not the only person asking that question, Robin. Every time we have articles come out, I hear from customers, employees, others asking, how is this happening? How is there another problem at the bank? I don't have the exact answer. I don't have the magic ball. But what I can tell you from our reporting is that there are a lot of problems at Wells Fargo. It's across many different businesses. If you look at any large bank and if you were to pull back the kimono, you would definitely find a lot of problems. However, Wells Fargo stands apart. There are cultural issues. There had been a lot of management problems. They've replaced a lot of managers. And at the core of it was that they had a completely flawed risk management program, which is how you find and prevent problems to begin with. So if that's broken, and if there are all these people in different business units getting away with bad activity and no one's really catching them properly, that's how a lot of this was able to keep going, and why the Federal Reserve had an enforcement action against the bank that was unprecedented, barring it from growing.
We're going to continue to follow this with Wall Street Journal's reporter Emily Glazer. Emily, thanks.
Thank you.
NBC News is again at the center of a storm. Two women, including a former NBC correspondent, have accused retired anchor Tom Brokaw of sexually harassing them in the 1990s. And former Today Show host Ann Curry said she warned NBC about Matt Lauer 4 years before his firing for sexual harassment. And Joy Reid, a host on sister channel MSNBC, she's also in hot water for a past blog post that demeaned gay people. She claims the comments were actually the work of hackers to frame her as a homophobe.
So lots to dig in here. Let's bring in NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin and Eric.
A little disclosure here. Tom Brokaw was a mentor of mine of sorts. I subbed for Jane Pauley at NBC, co-hosted the Today Show with Tom for years. This is probably going to feel familiar. He was thought of as the salt of the earth from South Dakota, married his college sweetheart. And then we have this interview with a Variety with former correspondent Linda Vester describing a time when Brokaw invited himself to a hotel room where she was staying.
He took the same hand, reached behind my head, and tried to force me to kiss him. I pulled back with all the strength I could muster and stood up. And I said, Tom, I do not want to do this with you.
So, David, this is shocking to a lot of people. Tell us more about the allegations.
Well, Vester spoke with Variety. She also spoke with the Washington Post. She said she was making these allegations public, not because she wants anything from it. She's not going to sue the network or sue Brokaw, but she claims that she has not seen the network address these issues seriously enough. She said she wanted this to be known. She said there were two instances in particular in which Brokaw effectively sexually harassed her, and that he sort of aggressively flirted with her on what's called the top line system. It was kind of an early rudimentary texting or email system within the network. And she told a friend about it at the time that spoke additionally with the Washington Post. She provided samples of her diary from that era in the 1990s. And so there is, seeming, if not confirmation, at least heft to give credence to what she's talking about there. Another woman who declined to be named also came forward and said that he had physically sort of embraced her underneath a jacket in a way that seemed sexualized as well. There appear to have been people who had heard such incidents prior to right now.
Yeah, David, I mean, he still works for NBC as a special correspondent and appears on air. What has Brokaw and NBC said about all this?
Well, Brokaw has released a statement saying that he met with Vester twice at her instigation to give her essentially career advice, and that the interactions were always professional, cordial, and appropriate. It was a very different account of what occurred, not one seemingly giving much for innocent misunderstanding on either side. NBC has been basically silent. I've sought repeatedly today to talk to executives there and am still seeking to do so. I think there are two complications, one of which, just as you said, he's still a senior analyst. Let's not forget, not only was he on the Today Show, but he was for many, many years the chief anchor of the network, a defining face for the news division and for the network itself. Wrapped in the mantle of the greatest generation that he chronicled in his books about the World War II generation, he sort of got a bit of that aura as well about somebody salt of the earth, as Robin mentioned. And also Andy Lack, who is the head of the news division now, was head of the news division in the 1990s when these incidents are said to have occurred. And he returned just a few years ago after different scandals involving a different anchor, Brian Williams. So this is problematic for leadership as well. They say there are no I believe they don't have any allegations that they've found that, were officially registered with the network. But, you know, we're looking to confirm all that even as we speak.
Well, David, I know we want to go on to some of the other things happening at NBC, but I just want to ask you, what are your questions when something like this happens from decades ago? You know, and this young woman, or at the time a young woman, very young, she was one of the youngest people in the network. She was something like in her 20s.
And early 20s,
early 20s, and a foreign correspondent, really being groomed for these terrific positions. Terrible position, she says, for her to be in with this person who was so highly regarded. What are questions that you have when something like this comes up?
Well, I think there are a number of questions. I think one question was this part of the culture? Were these individuals, or were they seemingly given license, as is suggested? You know, Ann Curry, the former Today Show host, has said that she reported Matt Lauer in 2012 as she left the network, but that it didn't seem to be taken seriously. They say they don't have records of any formal complaint being made, and there was different leadership at that time. The question is the nature of the culture. I think for a news organization, it's also, well, how does this affect the kinds of stories that made the air? Was sexual harassment not taken seriously enough by NBC early enough as an issue, not just within the network, but as a societal problem? If you have their chief news anchor and managing editor, somebody helping to define the newscast every day, who does this? And again, let's stress, these are allegations. These are not proven facts. But I think those are very questions worth asking, particularly if you think of two events of the past 18 months where NBC's come under fire. It's failure to reveal the Access Hollywood tapes about Donald Trump and his statements back in 2005 about grabbing women's genitalia as a celebrity, and that surfaced in the Washington Post rather than at NBC, which it was an NBC show, Access Hollywood. And secondly, it's holding back on the broadcast of the reporting of Ronan Farrow, which later surfaced in the New Yorker about Harvey Weinstein.
Right. David, you say you're not hearing back from NBC executives or spokespersons, but what about your sense of the newsroom there from folks you might be talking with, hearing from, or seeing on Twitter? How are they reacting to the NBC yet again embroiled in sexual harassment misconduct allegations?
Well, before today, I would have said there was wary hope of improvement and a wary distrust of what happened in the past, that the network had not fully come to terms with in an open way what had occurred. They've talked about having this full review that's being done that they said, we're going to release it basically good, bad, or indifferent at what the findings are. But those findings have not been shared with the network, much less with the public yet in the way that, say, NPR had done in its circumstances. So I think that it's fair to see what kind of transparency will really ensue. I think with Brokaw, this is a great shock for people who were not aware that these allegations had been circulating, that he had been such a venerated figure at the network and in the profession.
It's
stunning. It's something of a shock.
Yeah, it's stunning. I want to ask about Joy Reid at MSNBC because a Twitter user seems to have uncovered evidence that she made homophobic comments on her blog nearly 10 years ago. Now, this isn't the first time she'd been accused of this before. Similar comments resurfaced in December. She apologized then, but now is saying she'd been hacked. So take us deeper there.
Well, there are these posts that have been surfaced. A Mediaite, which is a media industry website, has written about this at some length. And more recently, in the last 48 hours, I guess, the Washington Free Beacon, a conservative site, has found other postings that seem to indicate a relatively strong, consistent streak of both skepticism and disdain for gays, for homosexuality, for culture that embraces that, talking about Brokeback Mountain, talking about disgust and seeing gay men kiss each other. It would seemingly conflict with how Joy Reid represents herself as a progressive on the liberal-leaning MSNBC evening, day in, day out, week in, week out. She has apologized, as you said, what's befuddling is that she's basically apologized for related kinds of writings in the past, which would seemingly, you know, add heft to the idea that she was capable of such things. Here she says, no, this is hacking. She cited a consultant who released his own statement. But the claims of the consultant that she has been leaning on seem to have unraveled in the face of relatively strong work by the Daily Beast, where she had been a contributing writer. Mm-hmm. And Daily Beast had said, you know, it seems as though your methodology doesn't hold up to scrutiny. And he acknowledged that fact. I think that NBC is going to be in a very tough place. NBC, of course, owns MSNBC. It's not just a question that she has something that she may need to apologize for if it proves that she wrote those things, but that she has claimed she didn't write those things. I don't think you can have a cable news host who is shown to have lied in the face of a controversy and crisis. And the real question is whether or not Reed's version of events is going to be able to stand up.
David, pivoting in the last minute away from NBC just for a second here. I mean, the president gave an interview to Fox News yesterday. He railed against James Comey. He railed against his own Justice Department, and there's word that he may, you know, appear on Fox and Friends regularly. Talk a little bit about this, that interview, and the growing sort of symbiotic relationship between Fox and the president.
It's a complete closed-loop relationship. There would be almost – there's so much genetic material shared there. There's almost no distinction discernible, I think, by forensic scientists. Right now, Trump is getting talking points and validation from shows like Sean Hannity's and particularly Fox and Friends in the Morning. And he seems to – it's like his daily intelligence brief, as has been described. And his willingness to show up there and just sort of talk, even in the face of Fox hosts who are desperate to hustle him off, is astonishing.
Well, and lawyers may be gleaning some information from him as well, as we're hearing after just kind of off-the-cuff comments. So it might be a good thing to hear what's really on his mind. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you as always.
Thanks, David.
You bet.
The five black women kicked off the course at the Grandview Golf Club in York, Pennsylvania last weekend, are not sure what happens now. Backing up the women, all middle-aged professionals, members of the club, and a broader organization for black female golfers called Sisters of the Fairway, were on the second hole when the owner's father, Steve Cronister, told them they were playing too slow and offered them a refund to leave. Shaken, they skipped a hole. By the time they got to the 10th, they were confronted again by Steve Cronister and his son, club owner Jordan, and several other white men. They were told to leave. Sandra Thompson, the lawyer, began recording.
It's 1:28. You got off the green at 12:45.
And so they're saying they want to kick us off the hole. And this is former Commissioner Steve Cronister.
Congratulations. You're a real winner.
So they say they want to kick us off the hole because we took a break in between the holes.
The police were called. Their membership rescinded. Jordan Cronister's wife called and apologized. But then in a statement to the L.A. Times, the club seemed to take that back. Monika Ojo was with Sandra Thompson when she recorded that video. Monika, take us back. You well know the rules of golf.
The rule of the game is that you have to keep pace with the people that are in front of you. When we all as a group approach hole two, there was a group already on the green just finishing up. And we saw Steve Cronister actually walking across hole one toward us on hole two. The assumption was that he was coming out to greet us because he wasn't in a cart and he wasn't in any distinguishing clothes that indicated that he was connected to the Grandview Golf Course. And so he approached Karen Crosby and myself and said, "I am the owner. You need to pick up the pace."
This was on the second hole.
This is the second hole.
You just started. Okay.
Yes.
So what are you thinking at this point?
You know, just to comply and keep up with everyone, we just skipped hole three and went to four. And so as we approached 10, there were some other players just about ready to tee off. The guys that were standing there with the beers came over to us and said, "Well, you're going to have to leave the course." And we're like, "What?" Three of the women, which were Sandra Harris, Karen Crosby, and Carolyn Dow, were too upset to play anymore. And so they left.
Well, this group of men is now crowded around you, including Jordan Cronister, the owner. Let's listen to a little.
Remove yourself from our premises, please. In the next 5 minutes, please.
Jordan, because the authorities have been called.
How are you feeling at this moment?
We can't believe this is happening. We felt threatened. They were approaching us. The other guy was holding them back. This has been totally devastating.
Let me ask you something, Monika. If there was some sort of way of calculating how much time you spent on each hole, and then the average is, you know, like supposed to be 15 minutes, 13 minutes, 15 minutes, if it turned out that you were slowing the pace. Do you think in that case it would be justified that someone come out and kick you off?
Okay, not in the manner in which it occurred. The protocols of the course is that we're respectful to each other, we're respectful to the players that are ahead of us, and we're also very respectful to those that are behind us. So our goal always is to keep pace with the people that are in front of us. We finished up 8 holes in 1 hour and 45 minutes, and that was with 5 players. The rules of the game at that particular course is that you have to finish up 18 holes in 4 hours and 15 minutes.
Do you think it's because you were 5 black women?
Yes, and both equally, both the gender aspect of it and the racial aspect of it. I strongly feel that the approach was based on the racial aspect of it. I strongly feel that the perception of them thinking that we were playing slowly was because of the fact that we were women. That is a bias in the sport, is that women play slower.
This happens, as there are other stories like this, as you well know. The 2 young black men at a Starbucks, police called on them, police called on you. Is this a life that you are aware of just suddenly becoming visible? Or are we in some kind of a moment here, do you think? There's more.
Well, I think this has always existed, but it's also contributed to people being more emboldened, being confirmed. There's confirmation now in society that this type of behavior is acceptable on the part of the owners and on the part of people that think like them.
Well, as you well know, JJ, the wife of Jordan Chronister, who's the man in the sunglasses who comes at you in the video, she apologized. They seem to be taking back that apology. But they're also saying that she, JJ, and her husband Jordan hope to meet with your larger group of African-American golfers, Sisters in the Fairway, to talk about how this could be a learning experience. Do you want to do that?
It was a horrific experience. It was very, it created a lot of anxiety. We had a lot of high hopes for, participating and contributing to this course. And so that the men, the York County Black Officers Association, many of their members rescinded the memberships.
In response. Monica, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Monica Ojo. And by the way, she says she and her golf buddies are considering that meeting with the Grandview Club owners in York, Pennsylvania, but just not now. They, by the way, the club owners, declined our request to talk. They said they had nothing to say. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Eric Westervelt. Jeremy Hobson's back Monday. Have a great weekend. You're listening to Here and Now.